This week's episode of Still Untitled is brought to you by Mindshow. Mindshow is a free app for the HTC Vive virtual reality headset that lets you become a character in a 3D cartoon. Characters move with your body movement and speak with your voice. Then you can turn your scene into a 2D video and share it on social media. It's like making your own TV show in virtual reality using a VR headset and motion controllers. You can choose from a ton of different characters, set up your scenes, and basically become a VR filmmaker. You got to check it out. Just go to mindshow.com for videos for more information, or download the free Mindshow app for HTC Vive on Steam and Viveport. And now on with the show. Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Norm.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Jeremy.
Welcome, Jeremy.
Jeremy Williams.
Greetings.
Is this your third time on the podcast?
Yes, it is.
Oh,
yes.
Notches on your belt.
Yep.
Yes, part of your 1-day carry. How's everyone doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm really... So it occurred to me last night to take my real horsehair barrister's wig that I bought on Etsy, which is what solicitors wear. Solicitor is a British equivalent of a lawyer. Is that correct?
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, I put that on the large-scale foam cutout of myself, and I'm really digging it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I don't want to put a lot of clothing on it. First of all, it's made of bead foam, so it'll collapse. Mm-hmm. Second of all, it's so weird having the cutout of myself in the shop that I don't want to cover it over, because it puts me in the uncanny valley every time I pass it.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a hat stand for you.
Yeah, except that I don't want to dent it by putting hats on it. Yeah, right? I mean, we covered it. We coated it in two coats of white PVA glue.
Mm,
mm-hmm. In fact, my shop assistant was like, "Yeah, I got asked what I did today. I said I gave my boss two coats of glue."
Watch out for those drippy bits.
But I'm digging it. I like the all white on it.
Yes.
So maybe it's a wig stand.
It's nice. It's a good way to practice or test out new style choices.
Precisely.
You would need to shave the head. Have it a dome if
yes.
you wanted to really have it. Yeah.
I've got that casting too. Over by the welding table, that's a casting of me when I was 25 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the very last time I shaved my beard, too.
Oh, my God. I
25
had no
years
idea.
Ago.
Unrecognizable. Completely unrecognizable. Things you guys can't see behind the camera. We're recording a little later this week. Apologies for that. But a bunch of stuff...
It's all Norm's fault.
...has happened, totally, since last week. You know, last week you got to chat with J.J. Abrams.
Boom, yes. J.J. Abrams and Andy Cruz from House Industries. I interviewed them on stage at the Norse Auditorium for City Arts and Lectures. What a lovely... lovely evening that was.
Oh, and in House Industries is like, I don't know how well known they are, but you would know their work.
You know their work. They did the Jimmy Kimmel logo. They do Hermes. They do Heath Ceramics. They sent me a gift, a swag package. This is how people who make products say hello. They send cardboard boxes full of stuff to each other. So Andy sent me this box full of wonderful House Industries dish towels and stuff. And it's like, I did a double take because I already own all their dish towels. I own their Heath clock. I own like half a dozen of their products.
I got to attend. Thank you. I got to attend the interview, mm-hmm. that recording session, because it's going to be broadcast on the radio in the Bay Area at least, and syndicated, I think, nationwide. But it was so cool. I mean, they were both super gracious, and hearing them talk about process, because I guess that was the theme of it, right?
Like, that was. So House Industries just released a 25-year retrospective book that's a magnificent tome, and it's called The Process is the Inspiration.
That's right, yeah.
And there are few phrases that I could sink my teeth into deeper than that one, because it's my whole life is based upon that, on mm-hmm. that principle and that understanding.
Yeah, and you know, they so eloquently said that it's what that means is just got to do the work, right?
Yeah.
If you do the work, you find inspiration as you do it. You don't just sit around looking and thinking about things.
And it also subverts this dominant idea that a creator comes up with an idea, and that's the hard part, and then they implement it, and that's somehow just the fait accompli. And it's famously exemplified by the idea that we have in the Western culture of Michelangelo going, well, I just took away all the parts of marble that didn't look like David, and then I created. And it's like, no, 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 no. We actually have a sculpture of Michelangelo's mid-process, and we can see him changing the move, the position of the head and the position of one of the arms. It is an organic process, and the reason we as creators and makers go towards it is because we never end up where we think we're going to end up.
I think that's super fascinating, because I don't think most people appreciate the amount of trial and error involved in professional works, especially when they see people like J.J. Abrams or yourself, that everything we see that you create is just, it's miraculous. It's perfect when it comes out. But the process is not always what people, you know, can appreciate.
Not only that, but the process is just so much more complicated and so much more winding. When we talk about failure with kids, we need to teach kids to fail safely. We mean exactly that. We mean you're not going to end up where you think you are, and that's actually the point. And I know from all my friends that have worked with JJ on the Star Wars films, he is always up for a better solution. He's always interested in a different way of doing something. He is, when he knows how to do it, he moves forward with all of his confidence. And if he's not sure, he's taking opinions and he's making the best call that he can. And he's, as he said on stage, every day he shows up on set and he's like, this one's going to be easy. He totally whack.
Right. And like, we're in the business of documenting process. That's what we do with One Day Builds. And as we've learned, unless it's being documented, even when it's being documented, there's so much, there's still 50% you don't see on camera. And so also, I mean, part of what you do is process archaeology.
Yeah.
I mean, when you have conversations with the pieces that you're researching, when you know, for painting, Renaissance paintings, when they x-ray into behind the paintings, that is the most interesting part. Yeah, there's the painting on top, there's a surface layer, there's the finished work, but what goes into it is so much more interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we'd be well served. It falls into the same category to me of thinking of science as an uncreative endeavor. And as we know, every scientist I know loves their job because of how deeply creative it is. Mm.
You know, I will use this opportunity to say that analyzing process and our own processes is the theme of our live show this year. Yes.
We
have a show in San Francisco, October 28th. It's called Tested Deconstructed, and it's going to be Adam, Simone, Tested team, some of our friends in the maker community talking about their processes. So it's going to be unearthing and peeling back the layers of their work. So,
I can't wait. Yeah. I'm really psyched about that.
You can go on the site to find more information. But the interview that you did was, I think, the first interview with J.J. Abrams, at least with him being
post the announcement that he is directing Star Wars Episode 9. Yes.
And I know that wasn't the point of the interview, but for you as an interviewer, I'm sure you're holding back and you wanted to ask him questions about it.
No, actually, so understand that he signed that contract or whatever that deal got made a few days before we sat down. That means there's nothing to talk about. There's no reveal he's going to make.
Yeah.
And so we sat down at dinner before the interview, and I said, you want to bring it up or shall we let the audience bring it up? Mm. He's like, let's let the audience bring it up. And I totally agree with that. That's the organic way to let that happen.
And go ahead.
I beg to differ about that there's no story there. I mean, there is the myth of when he began the whole Star Wars Episode 7 thing, that he had to be persuaded to direct that film. He didn't want to. He didn't feel like he was of that caliber. He didn't want to touch the story that was a part of his childhood. And then he was finally convinced to, and he did it, but he only agreed to one film.
Mm-hmm.
So why back?
Twice in a lifetime chance.
Right. Look, I have an interesting theory about why he said one and done.
Mm.
Because I think that as a franchise rebooter, which JJ is par excellence. I mean, you know, that first Star Trek is amazing. I think the second Star Trek film that he directed has issues. And I think that when he looked at that, I have this feeling in my head. We haven't spoken about it, but I have this feeling in my head that he was like, there's not a lot of percentage in directing the second one. Because if the first one's good, everyone's going to be holding that up against your second one. And it's a shit sandwich. There's nothing, you can't get anything out of that. Let someone else have it, which makes all the sense in the world. And I know Rian Johnson a little bit, and he's really ecstatic about Episode 8.
Yeah,
and even the original trilogy, they were all directed by three different people.
Yes.
And, right. You know, I think George Lucas had to learn the hard way when he came back and did the original trilogy, or the prequels, you know, that maybe to let it go. And he did let it go eventually. But yeah, the audience member did bring up the question. I thought very very gracefully too in asking about lessons learned. What lessons would you take from 7 and 9?
So don't get me wrong. There's part of me that actually, I absolutely would love to know the inner machinations. I just read about the fact that Lucasfilm and Disney had to pay Paramount a large sum to get JJ out of his $10 million a year contract with Paramount to do Star Wars. Look, those are machinations and deal points on a scale that I will never go near, and I'm fascinated by them, but I don't pretend that anyone's ever going to tell me how that stuff goes, so I just leave it.
Yeah.
I am just as interested as you in the actual facts, but I don't expect I'll ever know them.
We had some other Star Wars related activities in the office around our shop this past week. One, we'll talk about the Lego Millennium Falcon.
Yeah.
Because we haven't talked about this yet. Last week...
we got some insulting tweets about that.
I don't know. Why was that the case? So we were hooked up with a fan of the site, Tommy Williamson, who runs a website, Bricknerd.com, and the Lego community, they're ravenous. They're like, they're obsessed. They're in the best way possible. And this guy, Tommy, came up to our office, to our shop, and he had one of the, I think, the dozen only Millennium Falcon UCS. This is the Lego set with 7,500 pieces, $800. Yeah. People can buy it in the States at the end of the month. But he got a review unit, and we helped him build it. And it was like a two-day...
12 solid
12
hours.
12 solid hours.
With half a dozen people at any given time.
The box is literally so big that if you buy it at retail, I'm told, it comes with its own dolly.
Cardboard dolly that you fold out.
I tell you, if you pulled up in some like McLaren sports car, you might not be able to drive away with the Lego set unless you didn't have a passenger. Let's just put it that
right.
way.
The instruction manual is 7 pounds. I love like these little tidbits, right? Like, but it was such an enjoyable build. Mm. Both because of the finished model is beautiful and it being the biggest, the most pieces for any official Lego set, but also the collaboration that we got to, you know, we had a dozen people total working on it.
Super fun.
Super, super fun. Yeah.
You felt it important to say that we had at least briefly a world's record for speed build.
I think
that you saying that might have been what engendered some of the nasty tweets about the fact that it took us a total of 12 hours to do.
And that it was too long?
Yeah.
Well, we took our time. We were having conversation
as well. We were, but you didn't give that as a qualifier. I'm just saying that, like, Twitter and social media is, if nothing else, a deep weapon for the pedantic.
Mm, what? No.
The pithy but pedantic.
Yeah, the pithy pedantic. The pithy pedantic. It's a new children's book.
I'm more than happy to watch. And other people who have since bought the set, because I think you can buy it overseas now, I enjoy watching their videos, too. Of them building it. There's some really, really great ones out there. People are like just meticulous in how they've made stop motion videos, really beautiful. Like it's relaxing to watch people assemble Lego.
And finishing that beautiful, it was about 33 inches long. It's a large, large model.
Yeah.
Got me to pull down my D'Agostini Falcon.
Oh.
I've been a subscriber to the D'Agostini Millennium Falcon. It's this 100 separate steps, separate issues. You get 4 per month for 2 years, and it's $50 a month. So I guess I paid just under a grand for this thing, which is honestly for a 32-inch model kit of the Millennium Falcon, which is the size of the studio scale one for Empire Strikes Back. It's pretty good deal.
I didn't know it was the same size.
Yeah, that's exactly the size of the one from Empire.
Wow.
Well, they had the 5-foot model for
the 5-foot model was for Star Wars,
yep.
And that is. Full stop, one of the most beautiful models ever built for effects.
Yeah.
But for Empire, where they needed much more acrobatics out of the Falcon, they built a 32-inch, which they could motion control more easily. That's been a holy grail forever, and it's sitting on my bench right now, waiting to get fully repainted.
And that's not to say, because viewers have to know that Will and I started our own D'Agostini almost a year and a half now. We're going to continue working on that. We have the boxes, but Adam, I mean, this is one of your like projects that you just, when you find yourself in the shop, you're just working on.
Yeah, I actually built a large foam core drawer that sits up in my loft that houses it in whatever state it was in. And so I would pull it down every probably 4 or 5 months, and knock out 20 issues of instructions. It's a beautiful kit. It's got a metal superstructure on the inside, so it's hollow. I was able to actually machine a better mount for it so I could put it upright for painting. I'm not sure how I'm going to display it, but that mount will help me immensely.
Your customizations are awesome. And yeah, we'll document this. I know like we're on a streak of talking about projects we haven't shown on camera yet, but it's trust me, it's amazing. Custom parts too.
There's a whole cottage industry of custom brass etched and 3D printed aftermarket parts for the D'Agostini Falcon.
So speaking of process, how do those makers make these parts? Do they wait for the parts to arrive in the mail and then?
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Fascinatingly, there was a guy selling, what do you call the vents? There's six vents
on the rear,
rear of exhaust, the Falcon. Yeah. There was a guy selling aftermarket 3D printed and acid etched kits for those vents long before they showed up in the D'Agostini kits, because they showed up in like issue 96 or something. Mm-hmm. So before anyone had seen them, there was a kit, and the kit is crisper and tighter and much more beautiful than what came with them.
And the right size.
They know the scale, right? They're selling this for a scale. It's the same with like the Bandai kits, you know, 144th or 172. Like people are selling photo etch things because you get a lot of transparency and translucency and depth from these custom parts.
And you can go as deep as you want. There are kits for all the interiors, all the floors, all the lighting, which actually isn't in the interior sets of the... That's the other part of the D'Agostini Falcon, is you can pull panels off and see the interior with the Dejera table, the gun pods on top and bottom, the hallway to the cockpit. It's all there. Oh. That's really amazing.
Oh, that's so gorgeous.
And I don't know how much detail I'm going to get into with those. I'm keeping the Falcon so that I can still take it apart, even though I'm going to do a full repaint on it. And I've got some wonderful reference that I've gathered over the years from exhibits and from online and from friends and stuff like that.
My favorite part is the cockpit, because we made a much smaller version of the Bandai.
Yeah, the 1144.
Yeah, exactly. And that just has a bunch of fiber optic lights that are drilled into the back of the cockpit. And it's nice. And I love that. But now I see yours, and it's all the instruments are there. Yeah. Full decals that are all backlit.
Yeah.
It looks great.
It's really sweet.
Yeah.
Are you inspired to?
We got to inventory our boxes since we moved into our new office last year. But I believe we have all the boxes, and I've been trying to, watching you build it over the past couple months, you've learned lessons to make our build efficient,
I can totally make your build much more efficient. Here would be my first recommendation, and I came to this late, is the first half of the issues, like the first 50 or so, there's 100 issues total, are a lot of the frame and superstructure. And only after you get a bunch of that done do you start putting on the finer detailing. And it's hilarious because I'm noticing D'Agostini injection molded parts that are replicas of model kit parts that I'm familiar with that go on the outside of the Falcon. Like, oh, this is a Tamiya Flakbierling, Universal Greebly. Oh, here's a spool from a Panzer tank, and here's some tank treads.
That they had to remodel.
So if you're doing an issue of the D'Agostini Falcon where it's a bunch of sprue parts, they show you the sprue, they number the parts, but they're not numbered in any kind of order that makes sense on the sprue, because that was done for the engineering of the injection molding. So my recommendation is, for every issue in which you're assembling parts off of sprues, cut them all out in order and lay them out on a piece of paper. So now you're doing step one, step two, step three, instead of having to pick up the sprue every time, figuring out which was number 16, clipping that, sanding it, and then putting it on. I did all the clipping and sanding prior in order.
It's just like knolling Lego.
Plus, you can line up your full stack of 100 issues. You can set out a little foam core drawer of all the 100 kits so that everyone is ready, and you can just get started at any time.
That is satisfying too. The sorting, and yes, the organization. Because I know they ship it 1 month at a time, but having it all there, laid before you.
Now that they've shipped all 100 issues, every now and then on the RPF, someone will be selling the full ride, and I'm always a little bit late, but part of me wants to get another one.
What? I think they will sell you on their website the full one, like then you get a big
big package with all the
Do you get a break on that? Is it like $650 instead of $1,000?
I don't think so. Yeah, you have to check. But like, their website has pretty good models. I did some research because I'm also on a Star Trek Enterprise model kick, and I have some Bandai ones, and Jimmer, you and I built some Bandai ones. But D'Agostini had one that they prototyped and they had an ad for, video ad for, and then it failed, like, because it not enough orders. So they went through like 8 issues, and this is an Enterprise D with a cutaway, so you can see all the decks and all the levels.
Oh, it stopped mid shipment.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. So for the Falcon, luckily they knew they had enough interest to get all the way down. But yeah,
I'm having an interesting mental conundrum because I have some extremely detailed shots of the Falcon that this is a replica of. And the paint job is not amazing when you get really close up to it.
Of the D'Agostini?
The D'Agostini paint job is total shit.
you like bring your own paint.
Let's just be clear. Right. Yeah. Like, I don't mean it's total shit. I don't mean to crap on D'Agostini. They've done an amazing model. They've given me like a childhood dream. And it's a fine paint job. It's just nowhere near the level of beaten up and dirty and grungy that the real Falcon is. There's rust all over the real one. But when you zoom in and you're looking at it like this, the paint job is a little bit crunchy. And I'm going back and forth with myself whether I'm going to let it be that crunchy or whether I'm going to go for a finer grain of detail while hitting all the color points, right? Like, if you look at the real Falcon close up, the Studio Scale 32, you'll see rust spots that are like, you can actually see the brush marks of, like, you know, someone doing this. And water stains from adding a little detail to some of the high points and things like that. There are some details along the side that I can clearly see someone with an airbrush just going like this with a darker gray. I'm not sure that I'll be able to do that crunchy level of detail.
Intentionally.
I think I may go with a finer grain.
Yeah. Well, it's, do you want to build a replica of the screen used model that was not intended to be analyzed that closely? Or do you want to build your own Falcon?
And this is always a really important question to answer when you're into replicas like
I am. I imagine.
Because I look at the paint job that exists on it, and I'm like, wow, I feel like I could knock that out in like a couple of long days.
Yeah.
But if to really go in and use some oil paints and some, you know, washes to bring out the detail, that's like days and days and days, if not weeks, of really refined going through and layering in that detail.
To change gears for just a little bit, I actually remember.
I didn't give you a natural segue. Sorry.
No, it's okay. And talk about crunchiness and lived in worlds. Another thing that came on the past week that I think we were remiss not to talk about is you revealed that you had a cameo in the short film promoting Blade Runner 2049.
I did. Yes. I spent a week on set in Budapest.
Yes.
Alcon, the company that owns Blade Runner, has the rights to Blade Runner and funded this film, run by a wonderful group of people that I've been working with over the past year to raise the volume on Blade Runner. They knew how much I loved it. They sent me to the set. We have some videos that'll show up on test.
Yes, we can say that the videos, we can't say what's in the videos. Some of the stuff's come out after the movie release, but we did, I wasn't there, but you and Joey got to visit. And
well, so here's the thing is, they said, what do you want to cover? I said, well, I want to cover the artisans. I want to talk to the craftspeople making this film. I want to talk to the scenic painters and the stunt people. And it's best if you can really immerse me in this. And they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I heard you guys have like the biggest water tank in Budapest. Yes, they built a 1 million gallon water tank for key sequences of this movie. And by the way, I still have no idea what the plot of Blade Runner is. Like, none of that was revealed to me, even on set. But they had this 1 million gallon water tank, and I was like, so you can dump large amounts of water? So put me in a wetsuit and let's dump some water on me. And they were like, okay. So they did. Then, unbeknownst to me, they said, tomorrow you're going to put on makeup and we're going to put you in a scene behind Dave Bautista. And I'm in this shot where Dave Bautista is selling nematode worms to this guy named the Sultan. And I'm behind him also trying to sell stuff to the Sultan and a bunch of extras. There's this very sweet moment after about 45 minutes, I'm standing behind the man mountain that is Dave Bautista. And he turns to me and he goes, you look familiar. Are you a writer or something? Which I don't know what that code means, right? Like, you clearly not handsome enough to be an actor, but maybe you're a writer. You have a face for writing. And I said, no, Dave, I used to host Mythbusters. And he smiled. He did this deep sort of sweet, like, ah, smile. And then he reached out this bunch of bananas that he calls a hand and shook my hand and said, my wife is a huge geek and we love your show. We watched it a ton and I'm a huge fan. And I got to say, I spent 2 days with Batista and a nicer human I have rarely come across. Like a big, gentle, amazing guy who is also a phenomenal actor. Like, really, really listens and works hard and is, like, he's fantastic. It was a delight to get to know him on that set.
That's awesome. And you can watch, that's a short that I think Luke Scott directed.
Ridley Scott's son.
Yeah, it just kind of established the world. This one's called 2048, I think.
Is this a new one?
So they're doing a couple of these short films.
They did
leading
three
up.
Of them, and we haven't seen the third one.
Got it.
Yeah. So the first one was with Jared Leto. The second one is with Dave Bautista, and I don't know what the third one entails. Luke Scott directed the first two. I'm not sure if he directed the third.
I don't know either. Yeah.
Luke Scott has an interesting lineage to my prop collecting. If you remember in the movie Alien, where the three astronauts, Lambert, Kane and Dallas, reach the space jockey. They climb in the derelict spaceship on the surface of LV-246 and they see the space jockey. And there's this wide shot where the astronauts are dwarfed by the space jockey. One of the reasons that they're dwarfed is because Ridley Scott had 3/4 size spacesuits built that were smaller than the full-size spacesuits, and he put 3 children in them. And 2 of those children were Charlie Borman, John Borman's son, John Borman, the director of Excalibur, and Luke Scott, Ridley Scott's son. And there are shots of these two boys on set in the spacesuits looking so happy. And so when I met Luke Scott, I was like, do I have a picture of you wearing an alien suit on the set? And he was like, yes, that was me.
Oh, that's a great.
He says, I still have that suit. Wow. He still owns that suit, and it actually turns out that he had parts of that suit restored, and it was the restoration was done by some friends of mine.
That's so awesome. We'd also be remiss, not speaking of Alien, not to acknowledge Harry Dean Stanton, who passed this week.
An amazing, amazing character actor who, like, you know, he's one of those people like Don Cheadle. Like, you put him in your movie, and your movie's going to be better.
Yeah.
Harry Dean Stanton, is the last movie he did
The Avengers?
The Avengers, where he's there as the Hulk wakes up.
Right, yeah.
I
must have done some projects afterward, but I mean, you recognize him from so many films.
From everything.
Yes.
And he starred in the movie Paris, Texas by Wim Wenders, a wonderful film with Natasha Kinski. A fantastic actor who's had an incredible long run in Hollywood. Much better than I think sometimes he was given credit for.
Mm. Yeah. You guys watch any movies lately? Catch up anything?
I did. I watched Baby Driver last night.
Oh,
I can't wait to watch this film. I have no excuse not to have seen it yet.
Okay,
but everything I've heard has been that it's fantastic. It's about like the one of the best soundtracks you've seen in a movie.
Phenomenal.
And I love music.
An amazing cast. Everyone in it is incredible. Like really, it's like every time you turn around, you're like, whoa, it's Jamie Foxx. Whoa, it's John Hamm. Holy shit. Kevin Spacey is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's terrific. It's really, really good. I have this one pet peeve with the opening. That beautiful opening with him listening to music and the car chase, and there's all this, the filmmaking is absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And I feel like Ansel Elgort, that's the name of the lead kid. He's fantastic in the second half of the movie. Like as an actor, I think he's really terrific and delivers that role and is excellent. In the very beginning of the movie, he's asked it's almost a little like a music video. There's a little bit of that aspect to it. The film gets into this very almost mannerist territory. And
it's like a musical almost.
It's like a musical a bit. And it feels to me like the requirement of his character is to have an impossible level of charisma about him. And when I say charisma, I'm thinking Brad Pitt in Fight Club, and I'm thinking Heath Ledger in Knight's Tale. Right?
Presence on screen.
Presence on screen, and you just love this person. You need to be near them. They draw you towards them. And he doesn't quite sell that to me in the opening 2 bits. But that is the most minor thing. It is a super fun movie that had me like putting knuckle marks into my couch because I was so. Plus, I will also say this. The driving is maybe some of the best driving I have ever seen in a movie.
Incredible.
Ever. And it feels... I'm not spoiling anything. I hope not. It feels... to me, watching it, like it feels when you're doing that kind of tactical driving. I'm not saying I'm as good as that character.
You mean the filming, the way they filmed it, the way, yeah.
But tell me that they did film it, though, because my concern is always now that it's CG. You know, when you see what they can do with car commercials even, or with every car scene in a film, you worry now that, is this real, is it practical, or is this a CG effect?
Well, so understand that even when they're doing CG for car commercials, they're using, when one of the main things they're now using is a chassis.
A platform.
A platform that doesn't look like the car you're selling, but you can adjust the wheelbase and the camber and all of these things about it, and then they CG a car on top of that. So it's effectively a tracking device for a CG car. But a real driver is doing all of those stunts. And the problem with modern cars is that you need a computer programmer to hack the computers of modern cars to allow them to do things like power slides and skids and stuff. Because they are all geared to not do that. So the things you can do in a 1989 Mitsubishi, you can't do in a modern Porsche.
Right.
Because it just won't allow you to do... I'm sorry, I could be wrong about the Porsche. I'm sorry if I got that wrong. But
generally, yes.
In general, the systems of the car to keep you from doing that. The driving in this movie looks genuine to me.
And the movie's not a Fast and the Furious movie. It's not all about driving.
Right.
The driving, I think, is a big part of it. I always tell people, this is the movie that mainstream audiences thought they were going to see when they went to see Drive.
Oh!
And then they got the art film, which is great.
Right, right, right.
But this is that movie that fulfilled.
It's really good. I enjoyed the absolute shit out of it, and I highly, highly recommend it.
Yeah. I went the other direction. My 10-year-old had a sleepover the other night, and they wanted something funny. And I said, maybe this is it. We're going to try it. Holy Grail. Check it out. And it didn't work.
Oh, no.
No. They thought Black Knight was one of the funniest things they've ever seen.
Sure.
But they didn't get the rest of it. It was over their head or too long in between. So we cut our losses at about an hour, switched over to Young Frankenstein. Home run.
Home run.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because,
fabulous.
Because that's scary when it's not funny. And so there's something interesting all the time.
You know, it's funny. My kids are big fans of Wes Anderson, so I showed them Rushmore, and they're like, we don't get this movie at all.
That's my favorite Wes Anderson
film. It's my favorite Wes Anderson movie, too.
Oh, well.
But they get...
The jokes are slower in that movie.
Right, exactly.
And the mood is weirder, and it's harder... Like, that's one of the things that makes it so great. It's not leading you by the hand as much as many of his later films do.
It's more angsty.
Yeah. It is more angsty. Yeah. Both my kids were like, don't get it.
Yeah. There's a new trailer for his new film.
I saw that this morning. I have not watched it.
Yeah.
What else is there? Oh, okay. I would be... is this going up today or tomorrow?
Today, yes.
I would be remiss if I didn't say that I feel it is very strong. It's important that you call your congressperson today to tell them how you feel about the repeal of the AHCA, the American Health Care Act. This is an absolutely vital thing that we need to do to stop the passage of its repeal, because it is an onerous... thing that will throw tens of millions of people off the healthcare rolls. That's my personal feeling. I'm not speaking for you two, but please call your congressman today. Go onto Twitter, look up my Twitter feed, look up Jimmy Kimmel's Twitter feed, and you will find all the numbers you need to call to let your representatives know how you feel.
And watch the Jimmy Kimmel videos, because he's impassioned about this. And I know he's a comedian and he's like a late night talk show host, but he is informed.
Actually, his all of his statements have been fact-checked and found to be almost entirely true, almost entirely accurate in terms of his assessment of what this bill means and what it will do for people. And by the way, they're trying to pass this in the CBO. The Congressional Budget Office has yet to give it a score.
Yeah.
That's okay. Politics. Now, moving back.
I think that's it. That's a reasonable place to stop. Again, thank you for bearing with us for a late episode this week, but we will be back next week. We're all gearing up for New York Comic Con as well. So if you're in the New York area, Adam's doing not one, but I think two panels this year. So you can check their schedule for that. And we'll hope to see you in New York. And if not, we'll see you on the podcast next week.
I'm also going to appear in a staged reading of Plan 9 from Outer Space on Friday night at New York Comic Con with Janet Varney and Scott Adsit and John Hodgman and some other friends of mine.
Wow.
Yeah. I am so... I do nothing at those things but be intimidated by how brilliant everybody else is. That's my job at those things.
Awesome. All right. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.